Welcome to the High Velocity Radio Show, brought to you by the Desai Group. The Desai Group, getting the real work of innovation done. Visit them on the web at desai.com, D-E-S-A-I.com. The High Velocity Radio Show is where we celebrate innovative professionals producing better results in less time. Produced and directed by Lee Cantor and brought to you live from the Radio X studio in Atlanta, Georgia. Now here's your host, Stone Payton.
Welcome to the show, everybody. This is Stone Payton, joined by my producer and co-host, Lee Cantor. Good morning, Lee.
Good morning, Mr. Stone. How was your weekend?
It was wonderful. You know, one of our guests asked me that just a few moments ago, and I told him what made it wonderful is I did almost absolutely nothing.
The whole weekend?
The whole weekend. Watched old movies and played Xbox.
Is that a record for you?
Well, actually, it's beginning to get to be a pattern. Well, we have got a house full today. We've got several folks in the studio joining us and observing this morning, but I sure hope we'll join us on the show sometime, is Teresa Wolf with Giant Something. I'm sorry.
Giant Leaders.
Giant Leaders. And so we have her with us, and we have Rebecca Lovell, who is a charming young lady that our organization has engaged to help us become a little bit more famous. But we've got a marvelous show in store for you this morning. We're going to have in a little while a gentleman by the name of Jim Lester, who is a vice president with an organization here based in Atlanta called F-Trans, and has some exciting and interesting things to share in the world of finance and credit, and some specific advice in helping small and medium-sized businesses manage credit much more effectively than they may very well be doing now. But first up this morning is a gentleman by the name of Andrew Dietz. He's the managing partner for Creative Growth Group. Welcome to the show, Andrew.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, we are delighted to have you on the show. Before we dive too deep, how about giving our listeners just a little background on the Creative Growth Group and what you're out there trying to do for folks?
Creative Growth Group works exclusively with professional services firms, those of us who are thinking professionals who have to offer our brain power to business. And we help those firms get better at building sustainable, predictable revenue growth, so helping them with business development.
I understand you also have a bit of a focus and some specific things to offer your clients in terms of this issue I was talking about a moment ago, becoming famous. Can you say more about that?
Yeah, becoming famous, or the marketing buzz speak for that, is what's your positioning? I'd like the vernacular. Who are you? What do you do? And why should anybody care? Professionals have to, you know, whether you're with an enormous firm or you're on your own, what you really are marketing is yourself and your own ability to solve a business's problem in real time using your wits. So it's very, very difficult for firms to differentiate themselves one from another. A little easier for maybe a specialty practice area within a firm, but the real power comes when individual professionals differentiate themselves, when they're famous for something. So while we help our clients with tactically how they attract business to themselves, how they put themselves in a position to be bought, the keystone element of that is knowing what you're famous for.
And how do you go about that? Is there kind of a procedure that you work them through?
There is. You know, first of all, we take a there are really three core elements to what you're famous for. And by the way, we like that term, what you're famous for, because it's intentionally provocative and obnoxious.
Yeah.
They go, what am I famous? I'm not famous for anything. I don't know. We don't mean it as in famous like on the cover of the Rolling Stone or People Magazine or National Enquirer. We mean that you're the go-to person for something. You're especially excellent in a particular area of your practice, not only what you do, but how you do what you do. That's what we mean by being famous. To understand what somebody's famous for, we take them through a journey around three main points. Number one, their clients. You ask the average professional who they serve, and they're afraid to say one particular type of client. They say anybody and everybody, businesses. Oh, so you mean if, you know, I know the barber shop over there and the OK Cafe shopping center, and, you know, the guy that runs that barber shop might like to use your services. Is that who you? No, that's not who we work. Well, who do you work with? So We drive our clients to really be very specific about especially who.
So what do you think drives that fear? Are they worried about being pigeonholed and missing some opportunity? Or?
Exactly. So we have to, and we'd encourage any listener to think about it this way. Understanding who you're famous to or especially famous for is just that. It's about the word especially, not exclusively.
Mm.
We're not asking our clients to be exclusively about anything, but especially about something. It's not about what you eliminate. It's what you emphasize that sticks in an audience's brain.
So you're saying that if you have a client that, say, they're especially good working with accountants and they're focusing on accountants, that might also lead them to lawyers or other industry, but they would be especially good at accounts because that's what they focus on?
That's correct. The way our brains work is that, they're like filing systems. And when we, let's say, want to get a referral from somebody, and most professionals get their business through referrals.
Yeah.
But if you ask a professional, well, how do those referrals come to you? It's usually by accident. So what if you were intentional about that? Well, to be intentional about that, we need to guide our potential referral source to help us. And to do that, we have to help them know where in their filing cabinet of information, in their gray matter, they can identify something that can be of help. And the more specific we are in how we guide them, the better off we are. So we might say, I have an organization that's especially good at helping professional services firms. For example, we do a lot with accounting firms. Accountants don't go to become CPAs because they want to be salespeople.
And right.
Yet, if they can't attract clients, they can't succeed. So, for example, we work with accounting firms. Somebody is usually likely to make the leap to law firms, consulting firms, marketing firms, or any other kind of firm. But we've directed them specifically. So the starting point is clients. Who are you especially famous for? And by the way, there are a number of ways to describe that client. It's not just by, or that client you're famous for. It's not just by what we might call an objective, quantifiable, or demographic characteristic. In other words, not just what industry that client's in. Could be how they do what they do. Could be their culture. Family businesses operate differently than private equity-backed businesses, and they operate differently than publicly traded companies. So there's a psyche that's different. You could be famous for serving one of those types of organizations. Has nothing to do with what industry they're in, but how they're baked. Another way is what situation they're facing. You could be famous for helping a company in a certain type of situation. We're mm-hmm. especially good, for example, at helping companies when they merge to integrate certain processes around business development. So clients, that's number one, and there are a number of ways to slice that. And it's not about what you're exclusively famous for or who you're exclusively famous to, but especially.
Especially.
And then the second piece is what benefit you provide, what value you provide to that client, how you do that in a way that's different than anybody else. Just in the interest of alliterations and things like that, or mnemonics, whatever the term is, we've got three C's: clients, capabilities, and there's a third one I'll come to in a minute. So capabilities are benefits and value. What is it that you do that's especially unique? Again, professionals are often reluctant to be pigeonholed. They're afraid that they'll exclude something. But again, we're just asking you to think about especially what you do. There's a lot that Desai Group does. But Stone, what I understand is you're especially famous for helping companies think differently about innovation.
Right.
That's a what you do. But how do you do that in a way that's different? That may be certain secret sauce that you have, maybe a process that you have for understanding a company's innovation process or lack of one, and introducing one that's different and actually works repeatedly. How you do what you do is also a function of you and your likability and what your style is. Right? Just like products have different styles, there's a difference between walking into a Starbucks and walking into a Caribou Coffee, or driving a BMW and driving a Land Rover, right? It can feel different to work with a professional. So how does it feel to work with you? How is that different? All those elements, and then the punchline of all that is, how does all that benefit the client? All those things add up to that second piece, capabilities or value delivered. And then there's the third component. This may be a longer answer than you hope for. The third component is competitors. Who do you want to be compared to? Right? Positioning.
Yeah.
Positioning is the idea, which what we're talking about, what you're famous for. Positioning, you know, when I say positioning, what do you think of? What does that make you think of?
Like a brand position, you know, where
or
you are
how
the
my
market
customer
share.
Sees me.
Yeah, how your customer sees you. It actually comes from the idea of a location. A position is a location.
Right.
It's a location we might own in somebody's mind. How do we want somebody to think about us? Or think about GPS, Global Positioning Satellite. Right. So there are, how does somebody view us relative to our competitors? So that third part is competitors. How do we want to be perceived relative to others? And a good question to ask around how you want to be, or in the course of thinking about how you want to be famous or what you want to be famous for, is who do you want to be compared to and who don't you? You may name names. I won't do that on the air. But as for ourselves, I just say, you know, we'd like to be compared to the highest end, thought leaders in our particular field that focus on sort of whisper in the ear advice to the top level firms in the world, as opposed to, a training organization that just trains on selling techniques and tricks and tips to manipulate others. That's not our focus. We'd rather be compared to the latter. The former. Yeah.
Do you find, Andrew, at least initially when you start working with these clients, that they really they haven't thought any of this through and maybe don't have very good answers to these three questions?
In almost every case, they don't. And that's true whether we deal with the individual professional or the managing partner at a major firm. They really don't. Because traditionally, businesses just come in. And especially now in this economy, ain't so anymore. We got to be very intentional. The other key to about thinking about what you're famous for is professionals have very limited time. They don't have, in professional services, we don't necessarily have the luxury of being, having a lot of other resources to help do things for us. I worked in a major corporation for a number of years, and we had administrative assistants and specialists in finance and specialists in this and that.
Right.
As a professional, you're kind of do it all. Even if you're in a larger firm, you have to bring in the work, execute the work, help manage the firm, be involved in the community, and maybe even have a life outside of all that. So the question of how you spend your time is a really challenging one. Positioning, or knowing what you're famous for, is more than about coming up with an elevator pitch. It's about having a way to decide how to spend your time. So if you only have time to spend with one relationship in the market or to engage in one marketing tactic, which one and why? How would you make that decision? What you're famous for, your positioning helps you do that.
And then from the customer standpoint, when I realize what you're famous for, then I can kind of lock that in my brain so that whenever I think of that need or have that need, then I'm thinking of you. Is that the objective of all this?
Well, that's one part of it. One part of it is how others think about you, so that they can think about you more readily and more accurately and help you more directly, and you can help them. The other and perhaps more important part is, in a sense, how you communicate with yourself and how you decide how you spend your time. So, let's say you look at your calendar this coming week and you take a look at who you've penciled in for breakfast and lunch. I'd urge you to go back and look at that and say, well, which one of these folks really, if I build a relationship with this individual, which one best reflects my positioning and what I want to be famous for? Which one might detract from it?
It becomes the prism that everything is seen through?
Exactly. It's a decision tool. And everything you do should wrap around and reinforce that claim to fame.
And do you ever find that you go in, you have this conversation, you get people to sort of open their minds to this pattern of thinking, and now they're starting to have some answers to the questions, but they don't like the answers?
Say more about that.
Well, I was just actually applying this to our own firm, the Desai Group. If you were to come in and sit down with me and Jatin Desai and our VP, Dan Brown, and you asked us some of these questions, I have to believe we might not like some of the answers. You know, we might want to change.
Yeah,
some of these
that is often true, Stone. And so positioning is grounded in not only what you are right now, but it also is and or can be aspirational. What are you shooting for? How would you like to be famous? And then we can guide our efforts in that direction. And again, make sure all our activities line up and reinforce that aspirational claim to fame. What do we want to be known for?
So what's the most
fun? So there's hope for all of you.
Well, good. That's encouraging. What do you find the most fun about this kind of work? And as a sort of a follow-up, what do you find, if anything, frustrating about trying to do this for folks?
You know, it really changes people's lives. I know we're not curing cancer or anything, but on a small scale, if we can take what is otherwise a miserable part of most professionals' lives or their professional life, I don't want to be a salesperson. Well, you're not a salesperson, really. We're not talking about selling. We're talking about putting yourself in a position to be bought. How do you do that? How do you use what you have right now, the assets that you have right now? And what if you could be famous for something? Maybe even as famous as maybe being on the front page of your industry's trade publication or more. What if that could happen? Well, you know, what if you could not only use your existing assets, not be like anybody else, but be yourself and grow your practice? Wouldn't that be more fun? Wouldn't that be better? And what if you could not just chase random tactics, but you had a strategy behind it? You know, that might feel more comfortable. And that's what we're doing with our clients. And they feel the change and they tell us they're changing. And so in a small way, we feel like we're helping to change their lives. And that feels good. That's our favorite part.
Well, that has to be very rewarding work, I'm sure. I mean, you know, and what if they could get on like the High Velocity Radio Show?
Exactly.
Right?
People can dream, Stone. People can dream.
That's right. Don't give up that dream.
Well, now that I've achieved this goal, I don't know what's next.
You're done, man. That's
going to Disney World. I don't know.
Your cleats. You're doing something with your group that sounded very innovative to me, and I picked up a little bit about it on the website, but it's these Creative Advisor Awards. Am I remembering that right?
The Client Advisor
Client
Awards.
Award. Yeah, tell us about that.
Well, the Client Advisor Awards have a couple of purposes. Number one, they're a way to recognize the economic impact of professional services on a local economy. So those of us who advise, often behind the scenes, the major companies in any local market. In my case, we've launched that first in Atlanta. We're in the process of rolling our firm out into other major metro markets, but the Client Advisor Awards began in Atlanta. It's on its fourth year. We bring about, first of all, it's something that runs through the year, and we're accepting nominations right now for that. The nominations are for two types of award. One is an award for for advisors,
mm-hmm.
So professionals, and we try to put out in the public a set of criteria for how professional services firms and professionals should behave in their relationship with clients, from how they first meet that client to how they service the client to what happens after an engagement's finished. Equally, or maybe even more important, is there are awards for clients. We've all had clients from, let's just say, the southern regions, and they don't get our best work, those clients from, the difficult clients. So what if you could be a client from choice? I'm trying not to use provocative language. But what if you could be a client of choice? What would happen then? What if you didn't treat us like vendors, but you treated us in a different way? What would that mm-hmm. look like? And what would happen? What kind of value would you get out of an engagement with a professional service firm if you behaved differently as a client? So we try to set those standards. So there are awards for clients and advisors. And there's also an award that we've introduced last year for a client and advisor pair that have worked together in some way on behalf of a community activity, a not-for-profit, a charity. So that's the awards program. And, we've run that every year for the past 4 years. We've had about a couple hundred people come to the event. It's at a swanky private club here in town. I like to have these at places that normally wouldn't let me in, so that's good.
Yeah, good idea.
And, yeah, we have a keynote speaker, and there's we do a client advisor summit ahead of time as well. So I would encourage anybody listening who's with a professional services firm who thinks they're especially well-qualified to check out our website for the awards, which is www.clientadvisoravards.com. And download a nomination. We are now accepting nominations for the 2009 awards. The event itself takes place in December, first Tuesday in December, but nominations are starting now.
Oh, terrific. And what other ways can our listeners get in touch with you as they want to learn more about becoming famous and enhancing their practices?
Our website for the firm is www.creativegrowthgroup.com. And they may also be interested in our blog, which is Growing Professional Services, www.growingprofessionalservices.com.
Terrific. Well, thanks so much for being on the show. But you know, before we let you go, Andrew, we have a little tradition here on the High Velocity Radio Show where we ask each guest, if they would, to share a mistake that they've made somewhere in their career, and really more importantly, what they learned from it. Could we get you to do that for us?
Yeah. Well, you know, the challenging part of that is filtering through all the mistakes to find just one.
I'll bet.
You know, there's the line I heard about the CEO who, you know, was asked why he's so good at what he does, and he said, you know, experience. And they said, well, you know, how do you get that experience? You know, how'd you get that experience to be so high and lofty as you are? And he said, you know, decisions, you know, good decisions. And they said, how did you learn how to make good decisions? And he said, a lot of bad mistakes. And that's true for me as well. I'd say, though, that, you know, what I'm doing now, I love. I'm really get jazzed by it. Love everything about it. Love the people I'm working with. Feel like everybody we work with is a friend. And that's a really good way to live, not just to work. So I'd say, by contrast, the biggest mistakes I've made in my career have been doing things that I really wasn't jazzed about just because I thought a business was a business.
Yeah.
When I was in my mid-20s, I had the opportunity to join a family business. One of my family members had been very successful, sold his company and started a new one. Invited me to join him in a manufacturing company that was, you know, doing just kind of nasty, dirty manufacturing. And you know, my background was marketing, publishing, and advertising. You know, what did I know about running a factory?
Yeah.
And that was just a really bad experience from which I wished I would have learned once, but I did it again in my career another time. And, you know, believe that I'm now in a place where all the stars are aligning and I'm doing what I really get jazzed about. And life's totally different when you do that.
Oh, well, that's terrific, and we're happy for you. And I know that you've got to be delivering better value for your clients because you really are jazzed about what you're doing.
Yeah, enthusiasm makes a difference.
Yeah, I think it really does. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Can you hang out a little while we interview our next guest?
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
You're more than welcome. Well, next up on the High Velocity Radio Show, we are delighted to bring to you a gentleman by the name of Jim Lester, who is the vice president with F-Trans. And I had the pleasure about a week or two ago to hear the CEO of this organization share some ideas that really are new and different in terms of helping small and medium-sized businesses really get a handle on managing credit. And so without further ado, please welcome to the show Jim Lester. Glad to have you, Jim.
Stone, thank you very much. Good to see you again. Appreciate you having us in today.
Oh, well, we're glad to do it, man. Can you give us a little background on F-Trans?
Sure. F-Trans was founded in 2004 by John Hayes, and John Hayes was one of the original founders of Peachtree Accounting. And as you know, Peachtree Accounting is one of the most widely used accounting applications to this day. So Mr. Hayes truly was an innovator in the small business finance space way back in the day. F-Trans provides accounts receivable outsourcing services and a credit administration services to small to medium-sized businesses. And we do this with in partnership with banks. And the benefits that we bring to the small businesses are that we help them reduce risk, reduce the burden of doing credit administration, and helping them facilitate growth through good credit and AR policy management.
Can you kind of walk us through how your relationship works with a client?
Sure, absolutely.
What's their pain that they're feeling that they need you?
Well, as you would imagine, and everybody's been following the economic environment, there's a lot of pain out there. Whether you're a large business or a small business, you are perhaps constrained with your access to capital, and certainly we do see that out there. So our solution can help businesses get more access to capital at competitive rates. In an environment where capital is constrained, businesses need that capital for growth, and our solution can help them do that.
So tell us a little bit more about the way you go about approaching helping these businesses. I was absolutely enamored with the presentation that I saw a few weeks ago, and one of the things that struck me, I mean, what I know about accounting, you could stick in your eye and still see out, but I felt like I understood what was happening to the money when John Hayes was walking us through that example.
Stone, that's a good point. What John was showing our audience a few weeks ago was something that we invented called symbolic accounting. And if any of you are familiar with looking at balance sheets or statements of cash flows, you'll realize that if you don't, for a person who does not have a tremendous amount of experience reviewing those documents, that it can be a foreboding experience. So what we've done is we've developed a graphical representation of the inflows and outflows of capital within a business, and we branded this as the symbolic accounting, and visitors can visit that at www.ftrans, that's ftrans.net/CFM, which stands for capital flow model. And if you look at this, you can go actually and search for multiple industry types and see what the general balance of cash flows are within that business sector. And you can quickly see where your sources and uses of capital are. And what is really telling for many businesses is they do not understand where most of their capital is coming from, nor do they understand how they're using it. And with this model, they get a clear representation. For example, I'll give you an example here. Accounts receivables are, for most businesses, their largest use of capital. And think about that for a minute. The reason for that is that that businesses are buying raw materials, they are paying their employees way in advance before they're ever collecting a dollar on the product or service that they're selling.
Yeah.
Now, Walmart, for example, owes its vendors more than it owes its banks, if you look at their balance sheet. So Walmart is an example of a business that's using accounts payables, in other words, stretching out payments to their suppliers because it's free. And if you look at free for them, and if you look at this capital flow model, a business can quickly understand that, for example, if they're selling to Walmart, and they may not need the model to tell them this, but they're being stretched, and they're being stretched by other businesses as well.
So when you're saying being stretched is like maybe on the invoice it says due in 30 days, but Walmart's paying in 60 or 90 days?
That's right. And if you're going to do business with Walmart, you're going to know that up front. So that's an example. This, you know, really comes into play with almost every business, whether they're Walmart or not. And Andrew mentioned accountants earlier. And if you ever hear an accountant tell a business to manage your cash flow, it means, for a large part, pay your vendors more slowly. you mentioned about extending an invoice. An example we use often is if you have a car payment or a car loan, and you're due to finish paying that within 6 months, but you call up your banker and you say, you know what, I'm going to pay you in 12 months instead of 6 months when my note is due. And as a matter of fact, I'm not going to pay you any additional interest for that remaining 6 months. I think the banker would not go for that. As a matter of fact, the repo man's going to show up at your door at the tow truck and take your car away. Now, think about that in contrast to selling to another business. You're selling to a client, and you have an invoice with terms of 30 days, and the client calls you up and says, you know, Stone, I can't pay right now, but I'll pay you in 60 days. Stone's generally going to say, okay, fine, that's great, and Stone's going to sell them more products and services.
So why do you think that is? Why do you think we tolerate that?
The reason we tolerate it is because of standard operating procedures for businesses. That's how businesses have been operating literally for hundreds and hundreds of years. As a matter of fact, the general ledger double entry accounting system was created, I believe, about several hundred years ago to account for credits and debits when one partner sells to the other. And as a matter of fact, if you even take it back further, say millennia, you could imagine where there's a scenario where One person says, I will buy this amount of food from you, and I'll owe you two deer skins in the third full moon. You know, it really goes back a long, long way. Trade credit is what it's called.
Now, if a client contracts with you, how do you help them kind of shorten, I guess, those pay lags?
It's a very straightforward process. We work with them to understand their credit administration needs, and we have a web-based system. There's no software to install that allows them to start inputting all of their invoices, and we manage that from the point of entry. And the key here is that we're working with a bank partner. And once we expose those accounts receivables to our bank partners, because the way that we're managing it and protecting that accounts receivable, the bank then in turn can lend against it in a more effective, efficient manner and at a rate that's very, very competitive. We're talking bank cost, you know, bank capital rates as opposed to any other alternatives. So effectively, we're securing the collateral, which is the accounts receivable of the small business, so that the bank then in turn can advance payment in as little as 2 to 3 days.
You observed a couple of moments ago, and I don't think it's a secret to any of us, that, you know, for a lot of folks, these are tough economic times. I mean, they really are. But what are you seeing out there? What advice, if any, do you have to small and medium-sized businesses to get this thing reined in, get their arms around it, and not be victimized by it, and maybe even actually profit from the circumstance?
I agree totally, Stone. There's a lot of opportunity out there as well, and I would direct visitors to our website, and we have a book called Use the Credit Crisis to Grow Your Business. We actually believe that if you're using the right programs, one of which we clearly believe is ours, that you can grow in this time of economic crisis. We would actually, we've talked about being provocative here a little earlier with statements, and we would tell our sales folks and our business partners would tell our clients and prospects to be, we would be provocative with them. We would say, you think that accounts receivable management and credit administration is a necessary evil. You may think that, but indeed you should embrace it as a competitive advantage. And the reason for that is that if you are doing the best job that you can and you're professionally managing your AR and credit administration, then in turn, you can be in a stronger position than your competitors to offer the best terms possible or available and therefore grow in this time of crisis. And secondly, if you're diligently looking at who you're selling to, you can avert the catastrophic problem of having a big bad debt write-off, which can be terrible for a business. So use it as a competitive advantage and go out and sell more.
These really don't have to be paralytic times, do they? I mean, they can be catalytic times. I'm stealing that phrase. Remember when we had Jennifer Ruzek Lieberman on the show?
Yeah.
Don't you wish you could come up with phrases like that?
I know, that was a good one.
But it's so true. Now, are there certain industries, certain types of organizations that you find really need your service more than others and or have a tendency to resonate more with what you're describing?
Yes, indeed, Stone. We have a very diverse group of clients that runs the gamut from manufacturing and wholesale distribution to lawyers and professional services firms such as engineering services firms. So it really is a wide variety. Our largest client has a couple hundred million in revenue down to our smallest probably with less than a million in revenue. But for us, our solution is in particular for businesses that sell to other businesses. So in other words, it's B2B or government entities. And the reason for that is those are the businesses, per our earlier discussion about the history of trade credit, that have outstanding trade credit or accounts receivable. As a matter of fact, the average in the nation is about 50 days to collect.
Wow.
And for businesses with less than 30 or 40 million in revenue, that equates to $1.2 trillion in the U.S. economy that is on the shoulders of these businesses. They are funding their customers to the tune of $1.2 trillion. And in contrast, it is not for retailers, consumer retailers, because they already have a solution, and their solution is the credit card.
Now, in your case, were your clients, what's the average time lag for your clients? If 50 days is average for anybody, what are your clients?
Well, if you look at, so we have a rich repository of data from lots of sellers and buyers, and prior to us, they were in the 50-day range, as I mentioned, But when they use our system, they're going to get a payment in 2 to 4 days on average.
Jim, can I ask a question?
Please
this
do.
This is Andrew. All this talk about credit professional services it hits home, and it just reminds me, can I borrow $20 from you before we leave?
He'll gladly pay you Tuesday
for
a hamburger.
We could talk about that later.
For a hamburger now, right?
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
We have a solution for you, Andrew.
Thank you.
Well, how can our listeners find out more about F-Trans and learn more about really leveraging credit and not being victimized by this economy, but using these tools that you described?
Well, that's a good question. I would suggest they go to our website, www.ftrans, that's ftrans.net. And as I mentioned earlier on that site, if they hit /CFM, they can see the capital flow model and get a good understanding of how capital flows in and out of a business. So that would be the best way. We also have a blog called smallbusinessinsights.net, and there they can read information, commentary from our founder, John Hayes, as well as our CEO, Dan Dreschel.
And they can access this book. They can get that through your website, or what's the best way to get a hold of this book?
Sure, absolutely. They'll see on the website there's a link to the book, and we can send them a book, or, of course, they can buy it on Amazon.
There you go. Well, you know we're not going to let you go because you were here a little earlier when we had Andrew Dietz on. We're not going to let you go before we ask you to do something for us, and it's a little tradition that we have here on the show. We'd like you, if you would, Jim, to share a mistake that you've made somewhere in your career and what you've learned from it. Could you do that for us?
Absolutely, absolutely. And even though Andrew is much older than I am, many more mistakes in business than I have. I have had several as well. And thinking about that, to keep it in context of what we're doing now, when I was also in the professional services industry, such as Andrew doing technology services, we were doing a lot of venture capital back work for venture capital back companies. And so the funding for our projects generally was not an issue. So, you know, credit score, et cetera, they may have a good credit score, and we knew the funding was there. So all of the analytics said they're going to pay you, right? But there's another thing you can't gauge with a score, and that's called character. And we ran into a couple situations where folks would, look you in the eye and say they're going to do, pay you if you do A, B, and C. And unfortunately, they didn't have the character to come through at that. So my advice would be that no matter what type of business you're in and what type of a business arrangement you have with your partners, make sure you know them. Make sure you understand them.
I read a quote somewhere on my favorite research source, Twitter, over the weekend, but some famous banker guy actually said that, that he was asked, what is the best type of collateral? And he came back and he said, character. So what marvelous advice. I also want to mention, it'll probably put me in hot water with the software companies, but you specifically shared with us a little earlier that this tool you have is web-based. It's not a piece of software. Is that correct? You go out on the web?
Software is a service, so it is certainly technology-based. It's all web-based, so there's no software to install for either the small business to mid-sized business client of ours or the bank.
Well, I mean, as a small business person myself, you had me at hello when you talk about software as a service. I am absolutely personally fed up with it.
Well, our goal is to be easy to do business with, and that's part of that solution.
Well, it certainly sounds like you are, Jim, and it sounds like you guys are especially famous for helping these small and medium-sized organizations get their arms around how to truly leverage credit.
Thank you, Stone.
It was an absolute delight having you on the show, and I hope you'll come back sometime.
Absolutely.
Until next week, this is Stone Payton, Teresa Wolf, Rebecca Lovell, Andrew Dietz, Jim Lester, and my buddy Lee Cantor saying we'll see you in the fast lane.